Since we broadcast from and to Oregon, we hear the Oregon history of environmental gains on a fairly regular basis. You know, Tom McCall and the beach bill, the bottle bill, land use planning, and so on. Similar moves were going on in the state of Washington in the same period of history, the 60s into the 80s. And our guest this hour was involved in some of that in his work as a federal and state attorney, which involved some consumer protection work and criminal prosecutions, too. Bill Erksleben, once nicknamed Front Page Bill, is the author of A Lion Where There Were Lambs: The Quest for Truth, Justice, and the Rule of Law in the Pacific Northwest. Bill Erksleben is a former assistant attorney general for the state of Washington, a federal executive assistant attorney, and the one-time director of the Seattle Office of the Federal Trade Commission. Bill Erksleben, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, the rest of your resume could fill a book, obviously. Anyone have to talk you into this project?
No, it was a time in my life I was ready to set down some of the best stories and also life lessons learned.
Is there a single thing that you believe you're best known for?
I think, without being immodest, it's probably courage, because in the jobs that I had, I was willing at times to risk my reputation and actually my job in order to pursue the public interest. So it's kind of an unusual federal bureaucrat in part, considering the risk I undertook when I was a youngster to really pursue justice and the rule of law.
That's interesting, though. You consider yourself a bureaucrat.
Well, I was called a bureaucrat when I was working at the Federal Trade Commission. I was the regional director in charge of the five northwestern states, including, of course, Oregon. And as such, I supervised a staff of attorneys and also consumer protection specialists or investigators. And so I was dubbed by some as a federal bureaucrat when they didn't like the cases that we were pursuing. But basically, I was a federal prosecutor doing both criminal and civil cases.
Well, I guess this makes sure that you're not going to be a faceless bureaucrat.
I certainly wasn't.
Who applied the label of Front Page Bill?
Well, it's kind of interesting. That was applied to me by a political commentator for the Teamsters Union by the name of Ed Donahoe, who was quite famous in the Northwest for skewering politicians and federal officials and other officials for what he felt were overreaching things or things that were contrary to his view of the world. And he was called the Don Rickles, really, of the Northwest, because he would attach monikers to various people. For example, former Senator Slade Gorton, who's quite well known in the Northwest, was referred to as Slippery Slade. And I had a variety of nicknames offered by him over time. And actually, it was quite humorous. So he was the one that started calling me Front Page Bill when our cases received a lot of notoriety. And he thought I was practicing law on the front page of the newspapers rather than in the courtrooms.
But lest anybody think that the book actually—and there are illustrations in the book, and no newspaper—well, actually, there are a couple of newspaper things, but about things like basketball championships and stuff like that. But the book actually starts with a reprint of a handwritten letter, and I have to believe that was—that letter was sort of at the core of your motivation.
Yes, actually, it was. When I was at the Federal Trade Commission toward the end of my career, when I was involved in a lot of well-known cases, including the title of the book, which is A Lion Where There Were Lambs, which is actually part of a headline from the Seattle Times, which was describing my career. It was just a time in my life when, you know, I received a lot of notoriety, and a anonymous, for lack of a better word, little old lady wrote me a handwritten note thanking me for the work that I had done over the years, and also celebrating the fact that I had taken on a variety of vested interests. And she, in parentheses in her letter, said, "Goody, goody." In other words, she felt that she was one of the little people who was being taken advantage of in the marketplace, and she was happy to see that somebody was out champion her interests rather than the interests of large corporations.
You report in the book, Bill, that your mother said from early in life that you'd probably be a lawyer someday. Why did she say that?
Well, that's because, as you said, I had an answer for everything. You know, there was a lot of truth to that, but I've always been rather verbal and argumentative, actually, oftentimes. And so early in my life, she said, you know, you got an answer for everything. And my her punchline was, you'll probably be a lawyer. And she was prescient because about 18 years after she made those comments, I was a graduate of law school and starting my legal career.
Wow. If you'd followed your father's career path, though, and he died while you were in high school, you point out, you'd have been a doctor and probably a strict disciplinarian and certainly very conservative, but you didn't end up any of those things, it would seem like. What were the key diversions that led you?
My older brother took care of the doctor part. He became a doctor, so that burden didn't fall on me. And after he died, of course, his conservative viewpoints, I felt free of, and I started to chart my own way based upon my learning and my beliefs. And politically, I ended up 180 degrees diametrically on the other side of my father's beliefs, because he was raised in a very, very conservative religious environment in the Midwest, and he was a hardcore Republican that thought Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal, was a travesty. And he had a very different worldview than I had. So after his death, I headed off into my own direction and came out to the West Coast and became basically an idealist who thought I could make the world a better place, and that I could use my position as a lawyer and in government to try to accomplish that.
And the rest is the rest of the book, A Lion Where There Were Lambs, The Quest for Truth, Justice, and the Rule of Law in the Pacific Northwest. Bill Erksleben is the author of the book, talking about his own life. You can join us on The Exchange when we return in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to Bill Erksleben, who spent a good bit of his career as a government lawyer, both for the state of Washington and the federal government. If you're thinking, wow, that's an exciting career, well, it is, actually. He made it so. In his book, he talks about that career. The book is called A Lion Where There Were Lambs, The Quest for Truth, Justice, and the Rule of Law in the Pacific Northwest. I did not mention at this juncture anyway that one of his jobs involved running the Seattle office of the Federal Trade Commission when that was coming up in prominence in the early 70s. You can join the conversation on The Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Bill, it sounds like you formed a fairly lofty opinion of the importance of the law and lawyers. Would you tell us what the centerpiece of that is?
Yes, I will. When I graduated from college, I was a business major, and I was looking for a way to go forward in life with a more purposeful vision of what I could do and what I could be and how I could make the world a better place. Again, I was a young idealist like many students fresh out of college become. What happens, though, a lot of them don't have the opportunity to try to implement that idealism because they get caught in a regular conventional sort of job, and it doesn't allow for that kind of action or expression. Well, I was determined that I was going to find a career that would allow me to pursue my passion for justice and an attempt to better the world. So the law was perfectly suited, and the government was perfectly suited too, because when you work in the government, especially the federal government, you magnify your power. You just don't have your own power as an attorney, but you have the power of the federal government and its policies behind you if you can find a way to harness them. So when I was at the Federal Trade Commission, that's what we tried to do. We took an office that had not very much of a reputation. It had an investigator based in Portland that basically wasn't doing anything, and it was the time during the early 70s of the reformation of the Federal Trade Commission. There was a call put out for young lawyers to join the commission to embark on this crusade called consumer protection. And I was extraordinarily lucky and fortunate early in my career to have be offered the job as the Seattle Regional Director for the Northwest of the Federal Trade Commission, and have the opportunity to turn that office around from one that basically was being criticized in an agency for doing nothing to one that achieved a national reputation. And so the law, for me, was sort of my white horse. It provided me with a lance, which is the power of the law and the power of the federal government, to sally forth and try to make the world fairer for consumers and to provide an appropriate regulation, if you will, on businesses that wrongfully attempted to take advantage of them.
And we should point out that consumer protection had become a big deal through the efforts of people like Ralph Nader, who wrote the book Unsafe at Any Speed, pointed out how dangerous cars were, ended up with things like getting seatbelts installed in all American cars, things like that. But the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, did not have a good reputation. In fact, Ralph Nader himself criticized it, didn't he?
Oh, yes. And it was, in fact, there was a call to abolish the agency because it was considered to be a do-nothing agency with people who weren't very well qualified and were serving the business of business interests rather than consumers' interests. And so it was a contentious time. And one of the good things, maybe the few good things, that the Nixon administration did was to ride this populist consumer movement and rejuvenate the Federal Trade Commission with the appointment of very good administrators and who went out and recruited attorneys like me to help drive consumer protection. And for 5 or 6 or 7 years, we were on top of the world with all kinds of headline-breaking cases where we were going after various businesses who were violating the law and trying to change the marketplace so consumers were protected fairly in it and that the business, some business interests weren't taking undue advantage of consumers.
Bill Erksleben is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His love for the law and his love in practicing it comes through in his book, A Lion Where There Were Lambs, The Quest for Truth, Justice, and the Rule of Law in the Pacific Northwest. I want to come back in time a little bit, Bill, because we haven't gotten you out of law school yet. You got married to Gail partway through law school at Stanford, graduated, and then headed off for the Air Force. Why that?
Well, I was one of the many, many people during the students during the Vietnam War who was strongly opposed to the war and thought it was a great mistake, which in history it turns out to be. And the last thing I wanted to do was to be drafted, which I was subject to the draft, and go to Vietnam and to fight in a war that I didn't believe in. But I was no conscientious objector. I didn't object to all wars. I just objected to the wars that I thought were morally wrong, which was my opinion of the Vietnam War. So I joined the Air Force initially, and I was scheduled to be an officer. But while I was in officer's training school, I had an opportunity to shorten my career substantially by just converting over and spending my time as an enlisted man. And that's what I elected to do, and I ended up in Great Falls, Montana, at the Great Falls Malmstrom Air Force Base. And I spent about 16 months in the military, which I call a situation where I was involved in doing my best to deal with a military and an environment that I didn't believe in. And I was very heavily influenced by the book Catch-22, which said, when in a world gone mad, as I felt the United States and some other parts of the world had done during some wars, including the Vietnam War, you have to do what you can do to survive in that environment. And so I had a very, very humorous time in the Air Force, where I ended up as the on-base director of the College of Great Falls program in college courses. I ended up representing the University of Southern California in its master's degree program on the air base. And then I actually formed a volleyball team, and we traveled around the country and ended up placing high in the SAC. That's the Strategic Air Command Championships in Plattsburgh, New York. And so I had this very, very unusual career during the Vietnam War in the Air Force. And it met my objective of not participating in the war in such a way that I was going to be, you know, forced to go to Vietnam and to kill people, because that was, I thought that was morally reprehensible in a war I didn't believe in. But I managed to serve in what the chapter's entitled as a unique and unusual airman, because I was released early from the Air Force to take a job as assistant state attorney general in the state of Washington. And I was released for unique and unusual reasons, which my law career allowed me to research the regulations and find that you can be released from the military even in time of war if you can prove that your value to the civilian community is so much higher than your value in the military. And since I was a low-ranking airman, it wasn't too difficult for me to make my case.
Wow. So that's how you managed to get out in as little time as you did. Then how did you and Gail choose Seattle, and what were you thinking in terms of a place to work?
Well, that's because I came out to the World's Fair in 1962 with a couple of college friends. We worked our way across country and ended up actually in Seattle out of money and homeless, sleeping in parks, but we got a job at the Seattle World's Fair. And if you've ever lived in the Midwest and faced those tough winters and faced those humid summers, coming out to the Northwest and having a temperate climate, very, very few insects, beautiful mountains, beautiful beaches, just a beautiful land. It is a revelation. And so my eyes were open when I came out here to the Seattle World's Fair, and I said, boy, I want to live in the Northwest. And I managed to accomplish that, because after I left the Air Force, I applied for a job and took the bar examination in Washington State. And it's kind of interesting, my two choices at the end that I was focused on were Portland and the Seattle area. And it was only because I had two cousins in the Seattle area that Seattle won out over Portland. But the entire Northwest is such a wonderful place. And if you come from a little town in southern Indiana, a farming community like I did, it was heaven just to be out here. And for my life, which now it's in excess of 50 years that I've spent in the Northwest, it has been just the best decision I ever made.
Bill Erksleben is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, former Assistant Attorney General for the state of Washington, a federal attorney as well, and the director at one time of the Seattle Office of the Federal Trade Commission. He's written about his exploits in the law in a book called A Lion Where There Were Lambs, The Quest for Truth, Justice, and the Rule of Law in the Pacific Northwest. Join the conversation on the Exchange. If you have memories of Bill or just memories of that time that you'd like to share with us, join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So you got placed, you got a job in the Washington Attorney General's office and placed off with the Department of Natural Resources. In addition to your activist spirit about the war, were you kind of in an activist place about the environment too?
Yes, and that occurred when I was, my first choice was in the Department of Natural Resources, working with the timber resources and whatnot in the state of Washington. And basically at that time, two-thirds of the education budget in Washington State was supported by the timberlands that were owned by the state. They had, I think, as I recall, about 7 million acres of timberlands, and they were paying for most of the schools. And so I really enjoyed working in that environment, and that led, actually, after I left the Washington State Attorney General's office and went to work as an assistant United States attorney for the Western District of Washington, that led to my work on Puget Sound pollution. And basically, we filed a series of cases involving mercury pollution and pulp mill pollution to clean up the Puget Sound. And one of my helpers came from the Oregon U.S. Attorney's Office, a fellow by the name of Tom Lee, who was loaned to our office and came and lived up in the Seattle area while we were working on these cases. And we filed, during the early 70s, a series of landmark cases against major pulp mills and timber companies, including the Weyerhaeuser and Georgia-Pacific, to clean up the pollution from the pulp mills that was really decimating the Puget Sound. And so it was one of the early successful environmental efforts in the Northwest to really try to do something about water pollution. And I was very fortunate to be there at the start of that movement and to work environmental cases. And so after I did that, then, of course, I went on to consumer protection. So I managed to catch the major waves during the 70s of the rise of consumer protection and the rise of environmentalism, and to just work at that time in an area that was extraordinarily exciting and important from the standpoint of developing law and law enforcement.
Bill, you're on a cell phone, aren't you?
Yeah.
Oh, and suddenly you're louder again. Okay, you had receded from our view a little bit there, but you're back loud.
Oh yeah, I think my I think my arm just rotated down a little bit there.
Yeah, we call that the wandering hand in radio.
Yeah, right. You start to gesture with your cell phone, and it doesn't work very well.
Exactly. So you ended up involved in your time in the U.S. Attorney's Office in a big corruption case involving Seattle city officials. Can you set that up for us?
This was really the shock of my life when I came to the city of Seattle. I was born in Chicago, and Chicago's had a reputation and continues to have it.
Get the phone close.
A lot of civic corruption, and corruption in the police department. And when I came out here to the Northwest, I thought, well, this is great. These are young cities, Seattle, Portland, Vancouver. And they don't have the corruption in the government like they do in some of the eastern cities and in midwestern cities like Chicago. So the shock of my life was when I joined the U.S. Attorney's Office in Seattle that among my very first cases was I found out that there had been a history of 40 years of embedded police corruption, of payoffs in the Seattle Police Department, and that for years and years people were aware of it, but nobody was able to do anything about it. Because it was suspected that the prosecutor in King County, which covers Seattle, was tolerating it, that the officials in the city government on the Seattle City Council were aware of it, but were tolerating it. And the federal government previously had been, absent, the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office, in attempting to do anything about it. So a courageous U.S. Attorney, Stan Pitkin, decided he was going to do something about it, convened a grand jury, and started to question witnesses and ended up indicting on perjury charges the an assistant Seattle chief of police. And so he asked me to join that case, the investigation and the trial of that case, and it was one of the really interesting things in that case was that the FBI under J. Edgar Hoover suddenly pulled the two FBI agents who were our investigators for the office and said, well, we don't investigate local police corruption. That's the job of the county prosecutor. Well, the problem was, of course, the county prosecutor wasn't doing that. So I ended up for a couple of months actually on the street acting as a FBI agent, even though I was an assistant United States attorney, and getting policemen to confess to participation in crimes over 40 years. And so it was an adventurous time where my partner and I would be traveling around the city, knocking on doors on retired officers and confronting them about police corruption and taking their confessions and developing the case. The case ended with the assistant chief of police being convicted of perjury, and because it received such widespread notoriety, was covered in major papers across the country, it ended up, through the power of publicity, opening up the system to an election which changed the county prosecutor and basically shut down 40 years of corruption in the Seattle Police Department. So it was a major, major victory for us in that case, and it was a joy to have participated in it and to say, well, one of your actions as a young attorney resulted in the change in direction of city government in the Seattle area, where it had been permeated by substantial corruption, and now it was clean. And the good news is that over in subsequent years, a lot of the police departments, they revert back sometimes to former years of corruption. But the Seattle Police Department, at least as far as payoffs have been concerned, has not had a recurrence since the 1970s of the type of corruption that keeps coming back in cities like New York and Chicago. So it was a major win, if you will, for good government.
So Seattle has stayed clean, you're saying. So this whole cyclical corruption thing, and for that matter, I know the cops had said, hey, look, we run the racket so the mafia won't. Has the mafia made an inroad into Seattle?
No, that's kind of an interesting thing, too. You know, the joke had been back in the time that because we didn't have a substantial Italian population, if the mafia wasn't the problem. We were, you know, largely in the early years, Seattle was a Scandinavian area, and, you know, fishing was the primary pastime. But back in the early days, it was, it was thought that the reason that there wasn't a mafia present in Seattle is because the cops basically were running the major rackets, the major corruption cases. And the rationale, which is really strange to hear today, is that the rationale for doing this was, well, isn't it better to have the cops run, you know, the rackets, because they don't believe in, you know, in cement bodies in Lake Washington or in the Puget Sound. They only kind of get involved in the nonviolent rackets, prostitution, cracking down and extorting bribes from homosexuals.
All right, but all that has changed now, certainly after that case. Bill Erksleben, we have to take a break. His book is called The Lion Where There Were Lambs. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Bill Erksleben, who fell in love with the law at a young age and realized it can really do a lot of good for a lot of people if you're in the right place, and he made sure he was in the right place. A former assistant attorney general for the state of Washington, a former federal attorney in the state of Washington, and the former director of the Seattle Office of the Federal Trade Commission. He's written a book about his exploits in those jobs called The Lion Where There Were Lambs, The Quest for Truth, Justice, and the Rule of Law in the Pacific Northwest. And we're talking about the period when consumer and environmental protections were really coming to the fore, and he got involved in legal cases that made those things bigger. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone or by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I want to talk about one of your other federal cases, Bill. The people who remember the 60s remember the Chicago 7, but what was the Seattle 7 case?
Well, the Seattle 7 case was actually an offshoot following the Chicago 7 case. The plan was in the city of Seattle, following the Chicago 7 case and the verdict in that, the conviction in the Chicago 7 case, was to have a series of protests in Seattle. And the history in Seattle had been very violent during the anti-war Vietnam protests. Seattle, in fact, had the highest number of bombings of any city in the United States during this period. And so it was a very tense time, and a group of radicals in Seattle decided to hold a massive protest and attack the courthouse, where I was during that period of time, following the announcement of the verdict in the Chicago 7 case. And so on the so-called the day after, when these protests and riots started, they attacked the federal courthouse and hit it with paint bombs, tear gas was thrown. Police cars were damaged, police were injured, protesters were injured, arrests were made. It was a very, very violent protest. And as soon as that happened, the Nixon administration decided it was going to crack down on these radicals in Seattle. And so it sent out a team from the Internal Investigations Division to, in fact, secure indictments against them. And so in quick order, 8 people were indicted by the federal government in Washington, D.C., for a case to be tried in Seattle. And so the strange part of this is that the D.C. team was supposed to try the case, but they bailed out about 5 or 6 weeks before the trial and left it to the U.S. Attorney's Office, which was my boss again at the time, Stan Pitkin. So he was faced with trying these individuals in a case he was barely prepared for, and he asked me to help him. And so I had some compunctions about getting involved in the case because I wasn't sure who these people were, whether they were genuine anti-war protesters or they were, communists that were trying to overthrow the government or what the situation was. But I got involved in the trial. And so the trial started in Tacoma, and it went over 13 days. And there were a whole series of incidents and courtroom riots and demonstrations, and it became one of the most controversial trials at the time, other than the Chicago 7 trial in the United States for the anti-war protest movement. And so a what happened right at the end is the judge stopped the trial because of the actions of defendants and sentenced them to prison before the case had even ended on the grounds of contempt because they were causing so much disruption in the courtroom. And so the case ended very, very abruptly. And the Nixon administration was very proud that the judge handled the case the way he did, who was Judge Bolt in Tacoma. And surprisingly, 8 months later, Judge Bolt was named as the PISAR, who was in charge of the program to try to do something about the rampant inflation, which was a very odd appointment. So the whole case was extraordinarily controversial. And it was went down in Northwest history as one of the most violent courtroom scenes that were ever witnessed because there were fights in the courtroom between the FBI and the demonstrators and the defendants. And one of the attorneys in the case, a prominent attorney by the name of Michael Tiger, who went on to become a law professor, he was maced in the courtroom. And I was standing about 3 feet from him when a federal marshal grabbed him, threw him against the side of the wall and maced him. And he was running around the courtroom screaming, you know, I can't see, I can't see. So this whole courtroom trial was something that was absolutely otherworldly. And I was sitting there, you know, as a witness to history. And so what I do in the book is I try to retrace that history as it happened. And there's appropriate blame to be placed upon the federal government for the way it pursued those indictments, as well as the defendants, obviously, for the way they acted and caused disruption in the courtroom. But the case, you know, goes down in history, and what I did for the first time is to provide a point of view from the standpoint of the federal government or the prosecution. And so it's really been an opportunity for me to correct history to some extent, because about a 5 or 6 books have been written by the radicals who participated in that trial or who were involved in the movement. And there's a different picture from the point of history as to what actually happened. And I kind of saw myself as a witness to history and an opportunity to provide an objective view of the situation. So I hope that's a contribution my book makes to the historical record.
Well, one of the things you point out in this portion of the book is revolution is easy, but governance is hard. So, I mean, you took exception with some of the strategies of the Seattle Seven.
Yeah, you know, and that's one of the lessons I think that I learned. Where you know, the Vietnam War was wrong, but what was the answer to do something about it? We live in a democracy. And a functioning democracy, and the answer really to virtually all our issues is the ballot box. You can protest, and that's fine, but don't protest violently. Go to the ballot box if you want to change federal policy. And so the idea at the time, there were a bunch of radical former students, who are many of them who are graduates, whose view of the world was we needed to have a sort of Maoist, you know, Chinese-style revolution here. And some of the groups wanted to do it violently. The Weathermen was a group that advocated for violent overthrow of the federal government. And so whatever sympathies I had for the anti-war movement, I firmly believed that the solution to public action wasn't to try to overthrow the government through bombings and violence. And if you tried to do that, you're going to have to pay the price under the rule of law in a democratic system. And this was contrary to the view of many of the radicals who said, well, the war is immoral. We need to have a violent revolution. And my point of view always has been, be very, very careful when you're advocating revolution, because seldom does it work.
So let's talk about some of your work involving the environment as a federal attorney. You mentioned that you give Nixon credit for at least starting the EPA while you were involved in the federal government work. And but what kinds of laws were available for your use at that time?
Well, that's a very interesting backstory too, because the federal government really had no environmental laws on the books back in the early 70s. And the only law that was on the books was something called the Refuse Act, which was a law that was about 50 or 60 years old that said, basically creating pollution in the navigable waters of the United States is illegal, and it's the job of the United States attorney to vigorously enforce the law. Well, beforehand, there had been no vigorous enforcement, and people weren't sure of what the boundaries were for dealing with water pollution under this old law called the Refuse Act. Well, we took the act, and we decided to creatively start to expand its powers and started to file a whole series of actions in the Puget Sound to stop, again, water pollution by the pulp mills, where they were discharging not only some normal toxic chemicals, but they were discharging even mercury into the system. Anybody who's familiar with mercury knows that that has a residual life, and once you put it into the water system, it's very, very difficult to get rid of, and it's extraordinarily dangerous. So we managed to use that particular law to jump in with the United States Attorney's Office and ended up leading the country in terms of filing environmental cases that were of great import and also creating new applications of the law. So again, I was extraordinarily fortunate to have this opportunity to take an old law, and I was in charge of environmental protection in the office, and to kind of lead the way in the U.S. Attorney's Office to try to do something about water pollution in the Pacific Northwest. And so it was, again, it was an historical moment.
You filed a criminal case, I understand, against a politician under the Refuse Act. That must have been an adventure.
Well, it was. The fellow was a guy who lived on Kitsap Peninsula, which borders the Puget Sound area. And he was a big fish in a small pond. He served in the legislature. He was a major developer. And basically, he acted in the county as, look, I'm not going to get the permits unless somebody makes me, because I'm a big shot in the county. And he convinced the local county road department to provide him with 150 truckloads of fill because he wanted to expand his parking lot next to his restaurant that he owned on Dyes Inlet. And so he decided to fill in the tidelands and then asphalt it over so he could have a larger parking lot. Well, the Refuse Act says you cannot dump into the navigable waters of the United States without a permit, and they start at the line of ordinary high tide. And so basically he had violated the law, and so we filed a criminal action against him, and we almost ran into a serious problem because the Corps of Engineers survey was flawed, and we had to do some very, very creative legal work in order to reestablish the line of ordinary high tide. And again, here the Oregon U.S. Attorney's Office was of assistance to me because the environmental expert in that office, Tom Lee, gave me several suggestions on what to do. Well, net-net, we ended up winning the case. We forced the state legislator to remove the fill and restore the tidelands, and it was one of the very, very few injunctions in a criminal case. In fact, it was the first criminal case requiring an injunction removal of fill filed in the United States at that time. So it was an interesting expansion of the law, but it was also, I think, a statement that, you know, because you have political power does not mean that you're accountable. The rule of law must always win out. And so I thought, you know, applying the law to high-ranking local officials or to powerful businessmen was one of the best things that you can do as a prosecutor in terms of promoting and preserving democracy. And so that case ranks high in my memory as a interesting use of the law, basically, to help promote good governance.
We have about 2 minutes left with you, Bill Erksleben, and I just want to get some sense of what you think about where the world has gone since that time, though, because your general theme here is using the power of government to protect little people who might not have a lot of power themselves, and yet, you know, we've entered a time where people often get a sense that any regulation is a bad regulation and that sort of thing, and I just wonder what you think about how we've done environmentally and regulatory ways since that time.
Well, unfortunately, we've taken some steps back. Both the consumer movement and the environmental movement reached their heyday at the end of the 70s. Then we went into more, very much more of a conservative time. And ironically, the government, which was seen as the savior during the consumer protection environmental movement, was now seen as the enemy. There were too many regulations. There was too much government interference. And so, quite frankly, I'm extremely concerned now because when I see, for example, our government withdrawing from international climate agreements to deal with global warming and taking steps, for example, to enhance coal production when it is one of the worst sources of energy in terms of pollution and putting carbon into the environment, we're actually taking some steps backwards at this time. That's the bad news. The good news is that these things go in cycles. And I'm hopeful that in the near term that we will return to a time when we'll celebrate, again, environmentalism, and we'll celebrate also the importance of consumer protection. The new roads for consumer protection right now are, what do you do about privacy misuse by our, the social media companies who are taking privacy data and putting it in places where people who participate on these sites like Facebook never had any idea their information was going. So there are important things to be done, and I'm quite hopeful that we'll see in the near future, actually, a return to environmentalism and consumer protection, because quite frankly, in terms of my view at least, it is the way of the future that we need to preserve the planet. We need to have functioning democracies, and the only way that you can do this is to be fair to people and to look out for their best interest in the long term.
All right, Bill Erksleben's book is called A Lion Where There Were Lambs. You've had an interesting life, Bill. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks.